People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, a mom's story encountering video game addiction. 10 years ago, Elaine Uskoski got an SOS from her undergrad-aged son, Jake. Now, she's a coach helping other people experiencing gaming addiction. I reached her in Guelph, Ontario to chat. That conversation today on People First Radio.
I'm Elaine Uskoski, and I am an author and speaker and family coach for parents who are struggling with children and adult children who are screen or video gaming addicted.
And you recently made a trip to London, England, and I'm wondering if we could maybe start there and you could tell me about the reason why.
Yeah, I probably should have said I'm an award-winning author and speaker and coach. I did go to London early April. I was nominated and then made it to finalist in the Women Changing the World Global Awards and received a silver award in coaching and counseling for my trailblazing and groundbreaking work in video gaming addiction. I've been working in this area for 10 years now, and I'm one of the only coaches who only sees people with gaming and screen addiction. And I also have lived experience. So both of those make me unique. At the time that I started really uncovering video gaming addiction, it was late 2014 when there was very little being said about the addiction. And it was another 4 years before the World Health Organization classified it as a disorder. So, yeah, I was in ahead of my time, I suppose.
You alluded to it a little bit there, talking about lived experience. Your journey into this world, if I understand it right, really began in earnest with an SOS email from your son. And I'm wondering if you can tell me that story.
Yeah, it was Halloween, October 31st, 2014. Ironically, that's his favorite day of the entire year. Halloween, he's always loved it. I got an SOS email from my son who was in his first semester of second year university. And he had been backed into a corner where he hadn't been attending classes for 2 months. Instead, he was up gaming for up to 16 hours a night until he would pass out and then sleep all day. He was barely eating. He was barely thriving, barely showering. And the university caught up with him and said that you cannot live in residence. You're not a resident. You're not a registered student, sorry. And so because he had made payment late, he got the dates mixed up. And so he thought he was registered and they deregistered him. And then he spiraled out of control at that point, didn't know how to handle that situation, didn't call home for help, continued to tell himself he would handle it and didn't, and just delved into the gaming to really escape that. He wasn't feeling great about school anyway, as we learned that he had already failed 3 courses in first year and hadn't told us. So I think he was on academic probation anyway. He was on pretty thin ice. We were unaware of any of that. And so he wasn't calling home to say, hey, mom, I have a gaming addiction and I need help. He was calling home to say, here's what happened and here's how I've been poorly handling it. And the university has given me 3 days to move out and then the locks will be changed. So he was looking for a place to go, which was going to be home. And it was me who was putting the pieces together based on some of the behavior that I had seen, especially when he was home that summer. And I realized, okay, this to me looks like an addiction. And so I drove the long hour to his university to pick him up. After I'd spoken to him on the phone, of course, I immediately called and asked him what he needed, and he was quite fragile. So I went to get him. And when I opened the door, it was shocking, absolutely shocking sight. He's 6'2". He dropped to 127 pounds and he was shaking His eyes were dilated. He had terrible facial tics. He smelled horrific. His room smelled horrific. I think he'd been living in the same clothes already for weeks. And so it was very sad to see him in such a state. And so yeah, I brought him home. And we started the process of detoxing. I forced a detox. I mean, he didn't really have a lot of choice because he needed a place to live. He still was in quite a bit of denial about it being a gaming addiction. He believed he had a time management issue, which of course he did. But he also had a gaming addiction. And so we started the long, long, long process, which was a good 2.5 years of detox, relapse, before he finally decided himself that he needed to stop, that it was destroying his mental health and his opportunities for a future.
So that was 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago at this point. How's your son doing now?
Oh my gosh, he's doing amazing now. He is a software engineer. He does not make games with this company. It's a different kind of software company. And he is thriving in his career. He's living on his own. He has not gamed. It will be 8 years next month. Yeah, he's doing great. Much happier, much healthier, mentally healthier. And he sometimes speaks with me. Sometimes he'll do interviews and sometimes he'll do talks with me. But that's not his thing because he's got his own full-time job. He's been very candid and open about me sharing the story. He allowed me to interview him for my second book, and he got pretty raw about the whole experience.
If we were to talk about just zooming out video game addiction as a concept in general, is there any context people need to know about maybe the specific kinds of games that are more susceptible for people to become addicted to, anything like that?
Yeah, there are games that are more susceptible to addiction, but I think more importantly, it's certain people are more susceptible to becoming addicted. And for me, it's all about finding the core reason that they are driven to game in excess. And, how they ventured into it to start. Was it an escape? Was it a place where they weren't succeeding in other areas of their life and they needed an arena where they feel some success and high achievement, or both? Is there a mental health issue? Was there a trauma? Was there bullying? Is there neurodiversity? Because we have found a huge correlation between gamers, addicted gamers who also have ADHD or autism. So they're at high risk as well. Kids with, mental health issues are at higher risk. Kids in, toxic homes. So I look more at that than I do the games per se. But of course, I do think that the multiplayer online games that are free to play and have too much access are the bigger targets for addiction than the console games. Having said that, when Jake, my son, decided that he would stop, he stopped the multiplayer games believing they were the issue. And only played console games, and then found himself one weekend, 48 hours later, still playing a console game and realized this is also addictive. So then he moved to phone games, thinking that would be safe, and he became addicted to phone games as well. And that was really the final straw for him when he realized it didn't matter. He just can't game. Now, not everyone who's gaming addicted has to quit. It is a behavioral addiction, much like food or sex addiction. So we find a bottom line, a baseline that we follow, and you can learn to regulate and manage the gaming without entirely stopping. But for some gaming addicts, that's just not possible. And for Jake, he just doesn't want to take the risk and ever game.
You mentioned there it's a behavioral addiction. I'm wondering if there's any context you could give me around video gaming addiction, similarities, differences with other forms of addiction.
I mean, it does the same thing to your brain as a substance addiction. It does alter the dopamine and get you into that state of tolerance where you're now just going on cravings alone and needing more and more and more to keep the dopamine levels up. However, because it's behavioral, you can manage it and still have a life outside of it where you're going to treat it like it's a recreational habit, much like, I play tennis, so I like to play tennis a couple times a week for a couple hours. You could decide that you're just going to game a couple times a week for a couple hours. if you are addicted to food, you have to eat. And so those who are food addicted will, maybe follow Weight Watchers or stay away from trigger foods or count calories, and that would be their bottom line. And if they, were to fall off of the pattern, then they would, speak to the therapist again about what the trigger was, and then let's talk about what that trigger was and what other mental health issues that we still need to work on healing. Same thing with the gaming. If you're deciding that you're just like Jake, you're just going to game on consoles, and you seem to be managing that, and then suddenly you're 48 hours, then let's talk about what happened. What happened that drove you to want to game for 48 hours? Did you have a particular bad week? Are you spiraling down with your mental health? So what do we need to look at to, go back and reframe?
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Elaine Uskoski. She lives in Guelph, where she's a coach, speaker, and author whose work focuses on video game addiction. It's something she got into after helping her son Jake when he was struggling with game addiction while away at university. Jake Uskoski has spoken about his own experience in various interviews and podcast appearances. You can look for some of those online. What was the journey like from helping your son through this to becoming someone who's writing books about it and is coaching and is really professionally focused on helping other people through the same experience?
So I wanted to write a book on the transition between parenting your child and parenting your adult child because I found that transition really dicey. And I think a lot of parents do, and we don't talk about it enough. And just kind of asking yourself, well, who am I now? Am I parent? Am I friend? Am I advisor? We're kind of questioning what our role is. And of course, our young adult children are, busy being whoever they are and trying to sort themselves out. So they're not helping. And so I was struggling with that with my eldest son. And before I started writing the book, I discovered Jake's addiction, and he was 19 at the time. So now I had an adult child with an addiction. And what are my legal rights? What is my role in that? Parenting an adult child through addiction. And so I included that in my, it's pretty much a memoir of my parenting in that book. That book's called Seeing Through the Cracks. And I included Jake's addiction, but he was still addicted at the end of the book. It was not resolved. And what happened is someone from the University of Toronto, who is organizing their mental health forum that year, read the book and called and said, "You talk about video gaming addiction a lot in your book. No one's really talking about this right now, and we need to someone to come and speak." And so they invited me to speak at Mindfest. They asked me for an hour's presentation with Q&A. They wanted resources. And I was kind of green at that point. There wasn't a lot of resources either. And so I started doing some research on what was available. And in doing that, got connected with some other people in the mental health world. And that at that talk, someone from CAMH, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, and someone from the a social worker from the Catholic School Board were there, and they spoke to me afterwards and said, "You need to continue to talk about this." And so then I started getting invited to speak. Jake joined me to speak at the provincial forum for CAMH, I think the 2018. So it was 2017 when I first spoke. So we spoke actually together and then made more connections. And then I was introduced to Cam Adair from Game Quitters and eventually started coaching and then joined forces with Cam and became Game Quitters' official parent coach as well. So I have private practice and then I have practice with Game Quitters as well.
Either in your journey with your son or just the work that you've been doing subsequently, have you found that there's anything that tends to really help spark a turning point over and over again for people?
What do you mean by turning point? You mean discovering it or them changing?
Well, both really, actually, now that you mention it. I was thinking of moving past the addiction, but I'm wondering also about the idea of like accepting or realizing that there's a problem.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my clients, it's parents calling me, so they're all in denial. Very few of them are looking for help. And so I want to look at, because generally, if there's an addiction going on in the home and the parents have called me, there are problems in the relationship, right? They're not able to speak to their child, or their child refusing to speak to them, or the communication is very toxic in the home. So I'm working on building the relationship between the parent and the gamer first, and build trust there. And then, start slowly drawing them out of their rooms, out of their spaces where they're gaming, and getting them interested in other areas. Sometimes just getting them through school. A lot of my clients, because the average age of a gaming addict is a male between 18 and 25, a great number of my clients are young guys who've gone off for their first year of college or university and failed out because they spent all their time in their dorm room gaming. They weren't ready to go to begin with. I think there's a lot of work we need to do to better prepare kids for that transition. And so sometimes the coaching is just about, what are we going to do in terms of your education, right? Because we don't want them to stop because they didn't have a successful year. We want to build that academic confidence back up again, but we also, want to draw them away from the gaming in excess. And I guess too, once I find I can do that, and they are away from the gaming and having success in other areas of their life, it's a little easier then to get them to regulate and control.
A theme I'm hearing over and over again is that it almost sounds like the game is just something that fills the space of other issues that are going on in someone's life.
Yeah, absolutely. In intended clinical training for gaming disorder, we look at the three types: the escaper gamer. That's the gamer who's had some kind of a trauma, or has a mental health issue, or who has, toxicity going on, not just in their home. It could also be toxicity in their friendship circles. And so they're looking to escape the feeling. They don't feel good. That's one of the things that Jake was doing. He wasn't feeling like he was making the success at school that he wanted to, and his academic confidence was pretty crushed. And so he was escaping, looking at that and figuring out what to do. The second thing is the high achiever, and that's the person who's not having success in some other area of their life, be it relationships or school or work. And so they want a place where they can feel like they are successful. And of course, gaming is filled full of instant and constant reward. And you've got people saying, come and play. And so you feel good socially as well. You've got online friends. And so here's an arena that I can feel really special and feel like I'm achieving greatly. And then we have the hardcore gamer, which is a combination of the two, which is the gamers that are at highest risk of becoming addicted.
I'm really curious. I'm really fascinated by when you were talking about your initial motivation to write a book was to focus on this transition from parenting someone who's under 18 to parenting someone who's an adult. And then later you mentioned you feel like maybe as a society, we don't necessarily train teenagers to make that transition themselves in the best way is just sort of something that kind of happens in a lot of cases. And I'm wondering if you could just share more about that idea of why you were motivated to explore that and what you think we need to be talking about more when it comes to the transition to adulthood.
I think we need to do a lot less for our kids and stop rescuing them and telling them what to do. I think when they're teenagers, we start to make that transition. And what I say to parents is, when they're teenagers, they need to walk away from every conversation with you believing that you think they're capable. And if you're constantly telling them what to do, or you're judging when they come and share things with you, or you're dismissive in how they feel, then they're not going to feel confident to make that transition on their own. And there's a lot of handholding that happens even in school, in high school. And so, you make the transition over to university, and no one cares if you go to class. You don't go to class. No one's coming looking for you in your dorm. Whereas in high school, you're held accountable by your parents and the school. And so we don't do enough to talk about how you're going to manage that on your own. So you have to have a routine. You have to get up. You have to attend classes. You have to find ways to do your homework. You need to be joining some clubs and having some social activity and having balance. And you're going to be doing your own laundry and figuring out how to eat and how to live on your own. That's a lot for a young person to do. And if you read Jean Twenge's work, who is a researcher of generations, this generation is maturing up to 3 years behind because we are tending to hover and helicopter and rescue too much. And so if you're 3 years behind in emotional maturity, you're 18 and heading off to university, but you're actually emotionally 15. And no one would send a 15-year-old off to university to live on their own. And so I think we need to create opportunities so that we can help kids to be challenged and build resiliency so that they can manage independence much better when they go.
On that point, and also on the point of having a conversation about video game addiction in 2025, how do you think the prevalence of screens, of portable screens, of social media, how do you think all of that factors into this conversation?
Well, I think digital devices in general are shortening our attention span. They are creating space where we don't know what to do if we're bored because we're constantly being entertained. COVID did not help the situation at all. We learned in COVID that you can go to school, you can meet with your doctor, you can have friends, you can go to work. Everything can be done on a screen and online. And we kind of have to go backwards and reverse some of the damage that was done. Because a lot of kids I work with, they don't see any point in going out and having friends. They're fine staying in their rooms and just having all of their social contact online. And that's not healthy for kids. We spend a lot of time with our phones. They're in our hands constantly. I just read a statistic recently that 40% of 2-year-olds own their own iPad. And I think that's a very alarming number. There should be 0 2-year-olds that own their own iPads. Having said that, there's a lot of great things we can do with the internet and having our devices, and we can use them in a healthy way. There's nothing wrong with playing video games. You can learn a lot of great skills and you can enhance skills that you already have in video games, but those should be also translatable into other parts of your life. And those shouldn't be the only areas that you use your skills. I'm happy that they have decided, in Ontario at least, to take phones out of the classrooms in primary grades. And I think we should be delaying, giving kids cell phones and digital devices until they're mature enough to manage it.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Elaine Uskoski. We're talking about video game addiction. Uskoski's journey with the subject got started when she received an SOS email from her son, who was away at university at the time. Now, Uskoski is a speaker, author, and coach whose work focuses on gaming addiction. During that last segment, Uskoski referenced a statistic that said 40% of 2-year-olds have their own tablet. That likely comes from a report from U.S. nonprofit Common Sense Media. Based on an online survey of close to 1,600 parents of children under 8, the survey was designed by Common Sense Media and fielded by Ipsos. The report is called 2025, The Common Sense Census, Media Use by Kids 0 to 8. You can find it online. You have mentioned that most of the people you end up working with, it wasn't them who kind of made the referral to you. It wasn't something that was necessarily their choice to start working with you. How do you navigate a situation like that and kind of get someone on board?
Well, starting just with the relationship. So I do an intake with the parents, and then I have them have their child meet with me in terms of just family relationship, not about the gaming addiction. I don't delve into the gaming addiction immediately at all. I want to hear both sides. How do they perceive what's going on versus how do parents perceive, and just work from there. Usually in that first intake, I'm just looking to build trust and get an idea of where this child has gone astray or are lost in their digital devices, and see, do they want some help? Do they want to make any changes in their life? And not directly with the gaming, but usually they all want to be doing something better, or something different. So usually they're open to getting some, I would call it life coaching at that point. You didn't do well at school. do you want to go back to school? That's the same question I asked Jake. I said, what do you think the problem really is? When he'd had the first relapse. And he said, I'm not ready to grow up. I just want to play. I still want to play. And that's great. We all do. I mean, I have days like that too, where I don't want to be a grown up and I want to play. And I can't teach you that. You have to mature into that. And so I asked him, do you want to stay in university? Do you want to go back? Do you want a gap year? Do you want to change your program? That's entirely up to you because we can alter any of that. And he thought about it and he said, no, I want to stay in university. I want to get my degree. My next question to him was, sky's the limit. What can I do then? What can I do to help you with that? And he said, I need you to drive me to school and walk me to class until I can do it on my own. He was so afraid that if I left him on his own, he'd game again, that he literally asked me at age 19 to drive him to school and walk him to class. And so I did. I did that for several weeks. And when he felt ready enough to do it on his own for a while, he had to take pictures of himself in the classroom or the lecture hall and email so I could relax and know he was actually attending classes and he could be held accountable. And he had to continue to come home on weekends to be monitored. We went through that process for the next couple of years before he was able to finally be in school fully and not have to he could spend time on the weekends and go to the parties and join the clubs and have a typical university life that he wasn't having prior to that because he had decided to quit between fourth and fifth year, so he had 1 year left. And so that was his big test year and really the year that he could solidify community and friendships and all of the things that had been missing.
When it comes to video game addiction, is there any particular stigma that causes unnecessary negative harms or maybe prevents people from seeking help or seeking help earlier?
Yeah, great question. Everybody games. Everyone games. Why can't I game too? That's the biggest stigma. Not everyone games. I mean, a lot of young people game, but not everyone games. Yeah, I think if kids have a lot of friends that are also gaming, all my friends are doing it, all my friends have a digital device, then parents, don't necessarily want to have their child centered out as the different one or the weird kid that doesn't have a cell phone. That's a stigma. There are still a lot of therapists and doctors that don't think gaming is an addiction. I hear that a lot. So that's a problem. We don't know enough. We don't have enough research. We still need a lot more research in this area. But I mean, from my experience, it's definitely problematic. So there are, the signs that you can look for to know whether your child is has problematic or addictive gaming as well. A lot of parents don't want to get help because the process of perhaps detoxing seems really daunting to them. And a lot of kids who they've already tried that with at home without support and coaching, some kids become violent, quite volatile, and some kids become despondent and some suicidal. So that scares parents from wanting to take a look and get more help. But with the right kind of coaching, and support systems and emergency and safety plans put in place, we can, walk a family through a gaming addiction.
Where would you say something kind of ventures into the realms of a gaming addiction? How do you know that something has become problematic enough that it's worth seeking some help for, or really taking a step back and saying, like, yes, this is a problem that we need to name?
I'd say the biggest thing is they're not moving forward. So if they have quit school or they're not working, they're in their bedrooms for hours and hours and hours. A lot of my gamers are up all night sleeping all day. That's problematic. If they've stopped grooming and taking care of themselves, if they've given up friendships that they had in person and they're, only solely seeking online friendships while they game for hours, that's problematic. If they have difficulty stopping when asked and they can't stop, if they have meltdowns when asked, and if they constantly are thinking and talking about gaming and nothing else. They've given up all other activities that they used to love, for gaming. Those are all signs that it's headed to a difficult direction.
And a lot of your work, you said, is kind of like parents approach you with concerns about their children. What is your advice, or how do you approach that idea of navigating, like, when it's time for me as a parent to make an intervention, and how I as a parent can set boundaries or, like, still respect some degree of autonomy on my children when it comes to their decision to, like, sometimes game?
Yeah, that will depend on the age. As you know, I've worked with kids as young as 7 with gaming addiction. That's more controllable by parents and needs to be controlled by parents. When you have an adult that you're dealing with, you have to be more collaborative about it, and you have to build on relationships and, you know, get them to s slowly start getting involved in other activities first. I mean, sometimes if they're living at home and they're not paying rent and, you know, they're living off their parents and not moving forward, it's fair. It's fair for parents to say, I'm not paying for your phone anymore then, and I'm gonna, you know, turn the modem off at night. Parental controls do not work, so I rarely suggest those, because for every parental control, there's 20 YouTube channels that will tell you how to get around them. They don't work. So yeah, I don't look at a plan immediately for how can we stop or reduce the gaming. I look at how we can deal with the core issue first. If we start unraveling and start healing the core issue, it's then easier to pull them away from the gaming and get them to see that the gaming's a barrier to moving forward.
And you talked about how, in the case of your son, it was a journey of a couple of years of going through this process of, like, detox and relapse.
Oh yeah, it was a long 2.5 years. And he'd had a moment with his older brother that was really significant for him and changed his view about himself and their relationship, that started him to think about giving it up. But yeah, it, you know, for me, I knew he didn't want to be addicted. And so I always approached with empathy and didn't try to make him feel badly when he had relapses. If he had a relapse, okay, you've had a relapse. You know, what was the trigger? What's going on? You know, what are you struggling with? What kind of help do you need? I often just would say to him, what do you need? What do you need from me? I know this is really hard. What do you need? And sometimes he just needed a sounding board. He just needed to rant. Sometimes he needed me to go to the school and pick him up and rescue him. Sometimes he needed me to walk him through things. But generally, I tried to let him lead, and hope that he would finally see that it was problematic. I mean, you cannot force an addict to decide they're going to stop if they don't see it as problematic.
Are there any myths or misconceptions that you run into out there about addiction, whether it's video game addiction or more generally?
Yeah, that's in itself. Well, it can't be an addiction. It's gaming. That can't be an addiction. Yeah, a lot of people don't think it has the same effect as drugs and alcohol do. So they can't understand. When I tell people the state that my son was in when I opened that door, that's kind of what opens their eyes to, oh, this really does have the same symptoms that drug and alcohol addiction has, because that's what he looked like. He literally looked like a street addict when I got to him. So that's the biggest myth, is that, you know, how can, you know, something as innocent as playing a game become addicted? But, you know, if you look at gambling, it's a game. People become addicted to slot machines the same.
And certainly in the news media, that's one thing a number of game making, a number of publishers have come under fire for in the last decade or so, is emulating gambling features in their games with things like loot boxes to as rewards for players.
Yep, those exist for sure. That's really problematic, because some of my kids that I've worked with are stealing credit cards and money so that they can purchase loot boxes and so they can level up. You know, and parents are unaware. Often, you know, Google will store your credit card. So even if you don't hand them the credit card, they can somehow get the information. And, by the time the parent gets the visa bill, it's sometimes, thousands of dollars their child has spent.
I'll just say it again. What are the resources that someone going through this could potentially turn to?
Well, they can pick up my book, Cyber Sober, A Caregiver's Guide to Video Gaming Addiction. It's a good start and get well educated. And there's walking points in the book on how to get through it. There's coaching with me. I would speak with your doctor, speak with a therapist, anybody that is actually familiar and knows how to work with somebody who has gaming addiction. Even if you're just finding an addiction therapist in itself, as long as they have, they know what to look for and what kinds of questions to ask because they're familiar with addiction, that's helpful. Yeah, and talk to people about it. Don't keep it secret. Yeah, I never kept it a secret from my friends. And I don't feel any shame that I have a child that became addicted. And Jake doesn't feel any shame about his addiction either. It happened and we worked through it. And by sharing our story and talking about it, we can help other families that are having a similar experience and create more awareness.
Well, Elaine Uskoski, thank you so much for taking the time.
And thank you for having me. It's been great.
Elaine Uskoski is a speaker, author, and coach in Guelph, Ontario. Her work focuses on helping people experiencing video game addiction.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.